Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Liz and this is episode 92 on the origin of squamates. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Tiago Samoas, who just finished his PhD at the University of Alberta. During his PhD, Tiago traveled around the world to look at a lot of fossils, and I first met him on one of these collection visits in Germany. This large number of fossils put him in a very good position to take a closer look at the relationships of squamates, like snakes and lizards, as well as other reptiles, which led to a pretty interesting new study. This episode is an overview of Tiago's exciting new paper, hot off the press in Nature, so don't forget to check out the images on our website. And as always, I hope you enjoy this episode. So I am here today with Tiago from the University of Alberta, talking about the origin of squamates. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into paleontology and how you ended up at the U of A?
Hey, hi Liz. Nice to talk to you again. We've known each other for a few years now.
Yes.
And it's really nice to be talking about this with you. And I basically came into paleontology from my biological sciences undergrad back home in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I was doing my biological sciences at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Mm-hmm. And back home, we have the National Museum of Rio de Janeiro, which is associated with that institution, the Federal University, where we have actually a large number of paleontologists working there, and they have one of the biggest exhibits for paleontology in Brazil. So it's a fairly well-known institution, and I always had this particular interest on fossils and studying evolution through fossils. So really early in my undergrad, I went there to ask for an opportunity to do research in paleontology, mm-hmm. and that's how I came into paleontological research. I actually started to work on marine reptiles there, not squamates, especially ichthyosaurs and sauropterygians. My first paper was actually with a plesiosaur from Antarctica, mm-hmm. That they had recovered on an Antarctic expedition in 2007. But then after that, I started to study squamates, especially lizards from the Crato Formation in Brazil, mm-hmm. Which are the oldest known squamates we know in South America. And that was for my master's. Mm-hmm. And after that, I decided to go even further and deeper into squamate evolution. That's how I ended up coming to Canada to work on early squamate evolution with Dr. Michael Caldwell here at the University of Alberta.
So how does a Brazilian end up in Edmonton?
Yes, I heard that question lots of times. Yeah, the weather is quite different from plus 40 degrees positive, so 40 degrees positive to minus 40 degrees Celsius. So it's a quite drastic change. pretty much because of my interest on both marine reptiles and squamates, I was looking for someone who has a long established reputation and lots of skills on both groups and different research projects on kind of both kind of groups. And Michael Caldwell is actually one of the very few people who actually have a good publication record on both groups. Mm. And I met him in the SVP meeting, mm-hmm. In 2011 in Las Vegas. That was my very first SVP meeting, actually. Mm-hmm. And my master supervisor, Dr. Alexander Kellner, in the National Museum, he introduced me to Caldwell, mm. and talked about the possibility of a PhD here, and that's pretty much how I eventually actually ended up here.
Mm-hmm. And you just finished your PhD, right?
Yeah, that's right. I finished last April. So Now I'm a doctor.
Congratulations,
Yes.
doctor.
Thank you very much.
So I guess getting into it, I think the first kind of main question would be, can you explain what squamates are for those of us who don't necessarily work in that area?
Sure, no worries. Yeah. So squamates, they pretty much represent lizards. So including limbless lizards, mm-hmm. such as snakes. So commonly we see lizards, snakes, amphibians, and lots of other different kind of lizards with several different adaptations to several different environments. So that includes lizards that can run bipedally and even over water, like the basilisk lizard. In South America, we also have gliding lizards such as Draco, which is a kind of acrodontan iguanian. We have marine lizards like the marine iguana in Galapagos. And we have different kind of extinct species and wholly extinct families as well, such as the mosasaurs from the late Cretaceous period, which were large size marine reptiles, marine lizards specifically speaking, that inhabited the whole world during that time. So it's pretty much those guys.
And where do lepidosaurs fit into these?
So lepidosaurs is pretty much the name that we give to the group that includes squamates, so that is lizards and snakes and their kind,
okay,
along with another group called Rhynchocephalians, which pretty much includes the modern Tuatara from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Sphenodon punctatus, the species name, and all of its extinct relatives. The Rhynchocephalians, they're represented by a single living species, the Sphenodon punctatus, but they have a really rich fossil record in the Mesozoic. And during actually the Triassic and the Jurassic, we have a richer fossil record for Rhynchocephalians than squamates.
Okay.
So lepidosaurs is pretty much both groups.
Okay. And how are these related to things like crocodiles, dinosaurs, pterosaurs, typical reptile groups?
Yes. So that's actually one of the questions I try to answer in my paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a long time, broad-scale reptile phylogenetic studies, so those are the studies trying to understand the species tree, the composition of the evolutionary tree of reptiles, they have rarely included a rich sampling of squamates or rhynchocephalians. So the lepidosaur sampling of those studies was usually pretty mild, let's say, and with a rich representation sometimes of archosaurs, including those species you mentioned, like crocodiles,
mm-hmm.
Dinosaurs, and other stuff. And the problem with that is we had several different analyses showing very different results, and we had no real understanding of what kind of reptiles were the closest relatives to lepidosaurs.
Mm.
At one point or another, almost every single group of early reptiles have been to be the closest relatives to lepidosaurs. So archosaurs for sure, but sometimes more closely related to lepidosaurs than archosaurs. Marine reptiles like sauropterygians, so that's the plesiosaurs, placodonts, and other Triassic marine reptiles. Also a group called Iungainiforms, which are Permian aquatically adapted reptiles, quite common in South Africa and Madagascar.
Mm-hmm.
We also had turtles in recent years being proposed to be closely related to lepidosaurs, along with sauropterygians. So pretty much we've had almost everything proposed to be closely related to them.
Mm.
So as part of my big PhD question was to assess which were the actually earliest evolving squamates, and which particular groups of other reptile lineages are the closest relatives to lepidosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, which you can see in that paper, is pretty much there is no actual consensus. Each different analysis kind of tells a different answer.
Okay.
But what we can say for sure is that lots of those groups that previously were proposed to actually be their closest relatives are not their closest relatives.
Okay.
Most of them actually fall in other areas of the reptile tree of life. Mm. So Yungaian ferns are really more old. They are much earlier diverging in reptiles. They are not closely related to lepidosaurs. We also have some other taxa that have been previously proposed to be lepidosauromorphs, such as Paliguana, Paligama from South Africa, and also Saurus Terno. They also fall in most of the analysis that I conducted in my PhD in other areas of the reptile tree of life. And in the end, we have pretty much only archosaurs, especially archosauriform. So that's the early forms that eventually gave origin to crocodiles and their like, along with rhynchosaurs, which is an extinct clade of archosauromorphs, lying as the closest relatives to lepidosaurs. So at least from the most parameter-rich analysis that we conducted, it's pretty much the closest answer that we have as their closest relatives.
Hmm.
And some other taxa, other species that we thought that were early lepidosaurs, we actually found as to be the oldest known squamates. And that includes Megacurella, the main species we talk about in this paper, along with the Middle Jurassic Marmoretta from the UK. So it comes from Oxfordshire and the Isle of Skye in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And both taxa pretty much are now found to be early squamates, not early lepidosaurs.
Sorry, going back to this Megacurella, when and where is that animal from?
So that's from the Italian Alps, from the Dolomites in northern Italy. This specimen was found in the Monte Pradella Vacca, which is a mountain in northern Italy. It's about 25 kilometers eastern of the city of Bolzano. So it's actually a quite beautiful place. It's in the middle of the mountains and really beautiful mountains. Bolzano is a gorgeous city to visit as well. And the specimen was found really high up in the mountains, and it's from a layer of siltstones, and it was found with lots of terrestrial plants. But actually, the sediments come from marine sediments. So pretty much the specimen, along with lots of other fragments of terrestrial vertebrates and especially lots of terrestrial plants, was actually out into the sea and preserved this special layer, which was on the ocean, but which preserved even more terrestrial remains of plants and animals than of marine animals, at least in that specific layer. And the age of that is early Middle Triassic, the Anisian, so it's about 240 million years ago.
So you said that it was previously considered not to be a squamate. What were the reasons of the previous studies of why it wasn't a squamate?
So the previous studies, it was more about they couldn't really find a true answer or a reasonable answer to the placement of this species than actually being a squamate. They just didn't have enough data or a specific phylogenetic data set that could address the placement of this particular fossil, which is pretty much the same problem we had with other taxa previously proposed to be lepidosauromorphs. But we didn't have a very good understanding of where in the Lepidus or Tree of Life or in the Reptile Tree of Life, generally speaking, they would fit.
So
the very first study with the naming of these species in 2003 by Renesto and Pozzanato, they named the species and provided a description. They identified this as a Lepidosaur because of certain features preserved in the skeleton, such as a quadrate concha, the quadrate bone also being emarginated, the incomplete lower temporal bar, so that's the jugal not extending to contact the quadrate, quadrato jugal complex, the end of a quadrato jugal, according to what they found at the time. So all of those features told what made it clear to them that it was a Lepidosaur morph.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, in 2014, Renesto and Bernardi, they published a new paper for the first time actually including this species in a phylogenetic dataset to test its phylogenetic relationships, which is the only means that we can accurately try to position any species in the evolutionary tree.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried several different, but each data set would give them a different answer. And again, that's a problem that we had until now with several data sets.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, all of them having come on the problem of having a very weak representation of squamates and other lepidosaurs. So pretty much those analyses, they had squamate as a single data point, and it's really difficult to represent a lineage of 10,000 extant species plus hundreds of fossil ones by a single data point, right? So they could not really place it anywhere with confidence. And that's pretty much why the evolutionary relationships of this particular taxon were kind of murky until now. And that's how I came in to providing my PhD data set along with the data collected by Bernardi and some of my other colleagues to actually try to provide a data set which had enough sampling of every single major lineage of reptiles, including squamates, including morphological and molecular data, to be able to actually answer not only where this particular species fits into the reptile tree of life, but also other lineages and other species of reptiles of highly dubious placements until now.
So your new study or your new paper, I haven't actually mentioned this yet, is in Nature, which is exciting. And obviously, I guess the main draw is you've made this like much larger data set, kind of a larger matrix, including a lot more species than other people have made. So what kind of features have you found that supports this animal actually being a squamate rather than a basal lepidosaur or something else?
Mm-hmm. So some of the features that joined this particular taxon with squamates, a lot of them were actually obtained after we did the CT scan of this particular specimen. Some of these other features were actually already visible, such as the shape of the squamosal bone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a three-radiate bone, not a four-radiate bone, as you have in most other reptile lineages, and including sphenodontians and rhynchocephalians, broadly speaking, so which makes them different from the other kind of lepidosaurs, pretty much. But some other features which are quite interesting and very conspicuous to squamates include one feature case, which we call an expanded alar parotic ala, which extends anteriorly on the skull. So that's a feature that is common to many squamates, not to iguanians, but to many other squamates. We also have other important features that we found in the postcranium,
mm-hmm.
such as, for instance, the curvature of the clavicle. It has a secondary curvature, as we call it, which is something conspicuous to lots of squamates. Again, not in iguanas, but in several other squamates. And we don't see that in other reptiles. We have the shape of the humerus and the wrist. So the humerus, for instance, it has an expanded radial condyle, which is something other groups have it too, but the combination of that with clavicles plus the other features, it's something you only find in Scrum. It's, and in the RIST, there is something quite important, which is the first metacarpal has an expanded head, and all at the same time, you lack one important RIST bone called the medial centrale. Those features are common in squamates because pretty much what happens is you have an ontogenetic fusion of that medial centrale to the first metacarpal, creating this expanded head of that bone. So it has a larger head because pretty much the fusion of two bones.
I see.
Anyway, we have that in this particular specimen too. So these are some of the features we found there, along with, for instance, the presence of a splenial bone, which again, it's something we could only identify using the CT scan data. Mm. So the splenial is absent in all rhynchocephalians, including the very earliest ones. So another reason why it nests with squamates in our analysis and not with any other lipidosaur.
And the CT scans were something unique to your study that hadn't been done in previous studies.
Yes. Yeah, we're the first ones who scanned this particular specimen. Yeah.
Very cool. So in terms of sort of general large-scale significance, what I know you kind of briefly mentioned it before, but what is the kind of main significance of Megacorella being a squamate, and what does this mean for squamate evolution?
Well, it pretty much represents the oldest known squamate in the planet,
okay,
in the fossil record. So, and it is not the oldest one by a couple of million years; it's the oldest one by 70 million years.
Okay,
so that's a big deal because. For two reasons. One is that previous molecular clock studies had already predicted that the origin of squamates should have been way before the oldest known fossil.
Hmm.
It should have been in the early or middle Triassic. And this is supported by the fossil record in rhynchocephalians, that sister group to squamates.
Yeah.
Because the oldest known rhynchocephalian comes from the Middle Triassic. And so if they are sister lineages and the oldest known fossil from one group is from the Middle Triassic, that means that the oldest known fossil from the other group should also be from at least the Middle Triassic too.
Yeah.
So we already knew that at some point we had to have squamates in the Triassic, in the Middle or Late Triassic specifically. And finding Megacorella specifically in the Middle Triassic pretty much confirms that, and that prediction made from the fossil record and molecular analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, now that we have squamate that old, then what does it tell us? And it tells us some pretty important information, because as we would expect from something that older compared to any other squamates, it shows that some of the features that we thought that were typical of squamates are actually only typical of the main group of squamates, what we call crown squamates. So that's pretty much all the extant families,
okay,
plus a lot of the fossil ones as well that fit into those families. But that that those features do not actually characterize squamates as a whole, because the earliest members of squamates would actually lack those features. So, for instance, we know that most squamates, the extant families, they lack a quadratojugal bone. They lack belly ribs called gastralia. They lack a particular opening in the humerus called the antepicondylar foramen.
Mm-hmm.
And Megacorella still preserves all of those features.
Interesting.
Still has fused quadratojugal, gastralia, and condylar foramen. This particular, it's not totally unexpected. So we have an early Cretaceous squamate, which is, although it's early Cretaceous, not as old as Megacorella. It is usually found in most analyses of squamate relationships, the one of the earliest evolving squamates, called Huehuequetzpali from Mexico. And that taxon still has some of those features, especially the antepicondylar foramen. But the Megacorella, because it's older and more basically placed in the phylogeny, then it's preserved even more features, and that includes the Quadratojuba and the Australia. So those are features that are common to all reptiles, apart mm-hmm. from squamates. And now we know that those features didn't change as soon as squamates evolved. Actually, it was within the squamate lineage that those features eventually disappeared. And we have really complete squamates from the late Jurassic. Actually, prior to Megacurella, finding Megacurella as the oldest known squamate, those late Jurassic taxa are the oldest known articulated and well-preserved squamates for which we know the osteology. So they are from Zoohofen.
Yeah.
Limestone is in Germany, a very well-known Lagerstätten. And those taxa, which I actually had the opportunity to work on and re-describe last year, they already lack those features. They don't have Quadratojuba, they don't have Gastralia. So we, at some point between the Middle Jurassic and the Middle Triassic and the Late Jurassic, those features were lost. Of course, that's still a lot of time. That's 80 million years. So that pretty much tells us that we know little still of early squamate evolution. There's still a lot to cover from that time frame. Mm. But pretty much Megacurella, by giving us the first glimpse into these earliest stages of squamate evolution, answers a huge number of those questions that we had about what a very primitive squamate would look like.
Yeah. If we wanted to learn more about what was happening during that 70, 80 million years, where in the world would we look for fossils like that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, well, the Middle Triassic and the Early Triassic, there are some important localities in the world for lepidosaurs, generally speaking, potentially for squamates as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, there is one locality in Poland where one species called Sofineta was found. And Sofineta, in at least some of my analysis, it could be an early as well. So it's one of those complicated lepidosaurs. Nobody knew exactly where it could be an early squamate as well. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, more study on the Polish early Triassic fauna would be important.
Yeah.
The problem with that locality, as well as other similar, along with other localities, especially in the UK, late Triassic, early Jurassic localities in Wales or southwestern Britain, is that all of those localities, they are fissure filled deposits, which pretty much means that you have isolated bones of several different species at the same level.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is you need to reconstruct the whole animal, and mistakes can be made in that process.
Yeah.
So those localities are the most prolific in terms of number of fossils, but they are complicated in that sense.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, it would be highly important to actually find localities where we have articulated specimens for which we have no questions that those elements, those osteological features belong to the single specimen or single species at least. Some of those localities may include the petrified forest in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Triassic localities in South America, such as the Isquigualasa Formation in Argentina, the Santa Maria Formation in southern Brazil. Those localities have already proven to be extremely useful to understand the early evolution of dinosaurs. They're amazingly preserved dinosaurs, localities, and all your kind of archosaurs. But we have not yet, and some lepidosaurs as well. There is excellently preserved sphenodontians there, such as Clevosaurus brasiliensis.
Mm-hmm.
There are 3D preserved fossils there. And so we know that if squamates were around in the Triassic, that it's quite possible that we could find 3D preserved squamates there as well. I actually think it's a matter of time. And also more researchers looking for those, because we have a large number of vertebrate paleontologists who study mammals, dinosaurs, but very few who actually study fossil squamates.
Mm.
And you need to be specifically looking for those very, very small bones, which could include squamate bones, in order to actually study them, because we have sort of research bias towards studying larger body organisms or other kind of organisms. But people are rarely going to the field expecting or looking specifically for the very, very small fossils or microfossils. So I think that now there is more and more researchers trying to study fossil squamates, fossil lipidosaurs, and going to the field looking for them. And I think with in the next decade, we will certainly start finding more Jurassic and Triassic lipidosaurs.
So I guess another part of your study, or I guess more the main part, was that you did, you know, a very large phylogenetic tree looking at relationships, but not just squamates. You also looked at kind of all diapsid reptiles, or like a large group of diapsids. Can you explain a little bit about what you found that was different to previous studies, or sort of the significance of what you found about diapsid reptiles as a whole?
Sure, yeah. The main difference has to do with taxonomic sampling, as I mentioned. In terms of diapsid phylogenetic datasets, this is the one that includes the largest number of species. Several previous studies have included different diapsid reptile lineages at the family level, a few ones at the species level, especially more recent data sets published to understand the relationships of turtles, for instance. But there are still groups highly underrepresented in some of those analyses, squamates especially, and other lipidosaurs. What I tried to do was to have at least two, three taxa from every lineage. Sometimes I have four. I have four or five from each lineage. So I have more species for each major lineage, and I have every single major lineage, including marine reptiles and all major clades of marine reptiles, which not always have been included at the same time in those particular phylogenetic questions. And of course, most importantly, a huge sampling of squamates, which makes a big difference. The other main difference in approach was that I actually saw every single taxon, several specimens from every single taxon personally. So I actually went to over 50 museum collections and university collections in 17 countries during really, really intensive sampling periods of my PhD time. I wasn't at home for a long time, spending 2 or 3 months in a row on the road, including that one time when we met in Munich.
I was going to say, that's exactly when we met the first time, was both in collections at Munich.
Exactly. Looking at Jurassic squamates there. Exactly. So I spent a lot of time, actually, in the years of 2015 and 16, I spent a total of 6 months away in each year, which basically means I was pretty much as far away as actually at my home during those years. So it was a lot of time and money put into that to actually study. So even though most of my publication record has been on squamates, I spent a lot of time studying the anatomy of all of those different groups by myself in different collections and using the literature as well. But pretty much what I did was try to focus on seeing things by myself, and two main reasons. One is accuracy. Studying only from publications and from pictures is not the same thing as seeing alive. And efficiency, because you actually can do it. You can score information in a data set faster and more accurately when you're scoring those informations in your data set as you look at the specimens. So more than 75% of the taxa I actually scored in my data matrix while looking at them in those museum collections. So most of my data set was actually scored inside museum collections, looking at those specimens, not just from my pictures once I got back home, or my notes, actually them. Of course, sometimes I had to change because I changed my mind about some things, but especially doing in the museum collection. And I think that's actually one very important practice that really allows us to be sure about what you're looking at something. It also gives you more data. Lots of time publications don't really give you some details about some particular informative characters you think would be actually quite important for your analysis, and it's just not mentioned, not illustrated, or sometimes it's a hand drawing, and hand drawings reconstructions can be highly accurate.
Yeah.
So it's really important to go and see if those particular specimens actually match the holotype. Mm. I try to sell holotypes as well, and or as much as I had access to, and see if those match the holotype, which bones actually are well preserved, preserved well enough so we can actually score them or not. And finally, I had this study published last year in Cladistics, where I tried to reassess current approaches towards character constructions in morphological datasets.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a lot of emphasis to avoid biological or logical dependencies across characters or biases in the way you build your characters, focusing a lot on primary homology assets and so on. So it's a very technical and more methodology based paper, but it does change a lot how you see anatomical information and you try to code that in a way that is parsable by a software, and you can score that in zeros and ones in a way that it doesn't overweight particular features or create lots of dependent features which are dependent on each other. I'm not the first one who was addressing that.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people have addressed that before, but I was the first one bringing that up about to squamates at that level of debate.
Mm.
And I trying to incorporate that as much as possible in the way I was constructing my characters and which particular approach I was having towards scoring my specimens as well.
Just because I have to ask, you said that you sampled, you know, a lot of different diapsids and tried to get all of the groups, but did you put pterosaurs into your...
Well, I really wanted to.
Of course.
No,
you didn't.
I didn't, just because I lack of time. I really tried to sample as much as possible, and I couldn't have gone further into archosaurs and actually got as deep as early dinosaurs and pterosaurs and crocodiles. I actually even have a list of taxa I wanted to see for that, and I actually even saw some of those, including Dimorphodon.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, I just had to come back home at some point, and the money, I ran out of my time and money, and I had to finish a thesis. So that's part of my plans for the future.
I guess that's a good excuse.
yeah.
Just quickly, going back to what you were saying about diapsids, one of the things that you mentioned in your paper is that diapsids evolved not in the Triassic, but like much earlier on. Is that something that's kind of new to your study? Like, I don't know, you know, for people who don't know exactly when the thought of diapsids evolving, is that pushing back diapsid origins, or is that sort of what other people have said?
Well, not that many people said that. It's actually the opposite. So a lot of people have defended that the origin of those groups was in the Triassic.
Okay.
But that's the sort of question that, you know, that's the sort of issue that has been said a lot in the past without properly being addressed in analytical ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have lots of important fossils in the Triassic which are different from the Permian.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we had. And the logical conclusion for a long time was, well, then we had the origin of several new groups in the Triassic. And lots of these groups are the ones that give origin to important parts of the modern fauna, including crocodiles, squamates, lipidosaurs, lipidosaurs. Now we have the squamate, but previous lipidosaurs, marine reptiles, the extinct ones at least. So we have lots of new groups showing up in the Triassic. So that's the information we got from the fossil record. And for a long time, that was sort of the common knowledge in vertebrate evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the oldest known fossil does not represent when the origin of that group actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to actually address that nowadays that we have available is to perform to co-estimate what is the best topological relationships across species, along with the inferred divergence times for those species, along with other parameters such as the accumulated amount of evolution over time, which we call the branch lengths, and so on. So it's today have methods to do that with morphological data. And we have lots of different studies in the last few years, in the last decade especially, trying to understand the divergence times or the origins for several different clades of animals and, mm-hmm. and especially.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that nowadays. Initially, these tools were developed for molecular data, but today we can do with fossil only data if we want. So that's pretty much why I'm applying in this study. This is the first study that we do that for such a large sample of diapsid reptiles.
Mm.
And certainly the first one that we include molecular data along with the morphological data to co-estimate that. So we have lots of different sources of data. We have exon taxa, we have fossils, we have morphological data, we have molecules. So it's the most approach today to understand the divergence times for those reptile lineages.
Mm-hmm.
We also try to include some approaches that avoid some biases that we know that may happen in those algorithms that estimate that may provide two very old ages. So we are very careful to avoid having very old ages in our approaches, and we still had the origin of most of the diapsid groups prior to the Permian-Triassic extinction. To be fair, at the same time, we always had some of those earliest occurrences of those clades really, really early in the Triassic.
Okay.
So this Triassic already has fossils of ichthyosaurs, sauropter regions, archosaurs, really early middle Triassic of lepidosaurs. There is a recent paper proposing already archosaur fossils in the late Permian. So, if you have the oldest known fossils from the early Triassic, it's quite plausible that it could have originated prior to that.
Yeah.
And that debate actually has already permeated some researchers in particular taxonomic groups, such as ichthyosaurs, for instance. There has been previous proposals that they actually originated in the Permian, not the Triassic. So of course, I'm not the first one to propose that, but pretty much the general idea is that most of those groups originate in the Triassic. But there have been very few studies trying to actually address that with actual analytical tools that incorporate all of those sources of evidence and trying to utilize the most precise and up-to-date methodologies we have available. So in that sense, it's let's say the most accurate estimation we have at the moment.
So now we need to find a Permian clear diapsid.
Yes, we certainly can find some of those. We do have Permian diapsids.
Yeah. But I guess
for some groups.
Yeah. Of the other groups.
Notosaurus. Yeah. Notosaurus, which has made headlines in Nature before, it's a Permian turtle. So we have for some groups already quite well-established Permian species, but we still lack for some taxa.
Yeah.
It's quite possible we will eventually find Permian lepidosaurs, specifically even Permian squamates and Rico's felines. It's probably a matter of time, but it also depends on the preservation bias of the fossil record, right? Sometimes you just don't have the rocks, the correct rocks available, or people with access to those rocks, or the rocks available were not in the environment where those species occurred. So we may not find them, we may find them. It's difficult to know. But one thing for sure that is clear is that those different groups of diapsid, they really diversified a lot in the Triassic. They probably were not as diverse. They probably were much more restricted in diversity in the Permian. And that's probably one of the we don't find so many of those in the Permian. So one of the ideas that we throw in the paper is that the origin is prior to the Permian Triassic extinction, but the main diversification period was after that. So that's why we got those fossils in the Triassic and not in the late Permian, for instance.
Interesting. Just to kind of finish up at the end, where do you think is the next sort of big topic or question that we should be looking at in terms of diapsid phylogeny, squamates, this kind of whole topic? What do you think is the next most important thing?
Well, I'm really interested in several different areas of research in all of, in those groups, and I think to better understand early squamate lepidosaur evolution, which as we demonstrate has a deep impact on diapsid evolution, essentially to explore more Triassic and Jurassic localities, as we discussed, because we really lack more fossil information from those time frames. And that's a lot of time. There is a lot of rocks in several different countries that can be explored. So I'm pretty sure we're going to be finding a lot of quite interesting things in those rocks, and which will answer some questions still out there, such as for instance, I believe that we have several extinct families of squamates that we don't know of. We know some of the late Cretaceous extinct families, such as polyglyphanodontids, that inhabited North America and Eastern Asia. But we know that because they have a really rich record of fossil squamate mutations. And especially because the origin of most of the extant families is in the Cretaceous or late Jurassic, imagine what we can find in the earliest Jurassic or late Triassic. There's probably entire lineages of fossil squamates and other groups of reptiles we're completely clueless right now, especially in the case of squamates. There might be entirely new body plans that we never thought of in the early evolution of squamates, which we just don't know yet. So I think there is a lot of opportunities of research over there.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much for talking with me, Tiago, and congratulations on your new paper.
Oh, thank you very much, Liz. Nice talking to you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/PaleoCast to get all the latest news.